Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is David Heska Wandley-Wyden, author of the novel Winter Counts, an intense, wide-ranging literary thriller set on the Rosebud Reservation in rural South Dakota, starring a vigilante for hire named Virgil Wounded Horse. Since the passage of the Major Crimes Act of 1885, felonies committed on Native American reservations have been under the jurisdiction of the federal government, which often declines to prosecute sexual assaults and other violent crimes. In Winter Counts, when the judicial system fails families on the Rosebud Reservation, they call Virgil Wounded Horse to bring the criminals to justice at the going rate of $100 per broken bone. When someone starts selling black tar heroin on the res, and someone close to Virgil gets hurt, he teams up with an old flame to find the dealers and exact vengeance. In addition to being the author of this standout thriller, David Heska Wandley-Wyden is the author of Spotted Tail, a biography of the great Lakota leader. That's for young readers. He holds a J.D., Ph.D., and M.F.A., teaches writing, and is a professor of Native American Studies and Political Science at Metropolitan State University of Denver. He lives in Colorado with his family. He will join us from Colorado soon. But first, a word from one of our sponsors for this episode, Amazon Original Stories, about their thrilling Hush collection. What is the truth? How do you trust what you think you know? In stories featuring conspirators, psychics, deceptive lovers, and desperate killers, some of today's most popular crime writers, including Ruth Ware, Oyinkan Breathwaite, and Lisa Unger, explore the very nature of truth and the risks in uncovering the lies. Read the Hush collection from Amazon Original Stories. Visit amazon.com/hush. And now, let's talk with David Heska Wandley-Wyden about Winter Counts. Welcome, David, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited to discuss this novel, Winter Counts. It completely rewrote my idea of what a literary thriller could do.
Well, again, thank you so much.
First things first, by way of introduction, giving away as little of the plot as possible, because we want readers to be able to enjoy for themselves, what is this book about?
Well, the book is the story of Virgil Wounded Horse. That is my protagonist, and he is a hired vigilante on the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Now, I am an enrolled citizen of the Sichangu Lakota Nation. We are located on the Rosebud Reservation. And so Virgil is based upon real people that actually exist on my native reservation. So again, he is a hired enforcer. And sort of the premise of the book is this. There is a law that was passed by the U.S. Congress way back in 1885 called the Major Crimes Act. And the Major Crimes Act is a law that takes away the right of Native nations to prosecute serious felony crimes that occur on their own lands. So if somebody does a bad crime on the reservation and the tribal police arrest the person, they have to call in the FBI and the U.S. prosecutors and hand the person over to them. But about one-third to half of the time, the federal prosecutors decline the case. They decline to prosecute, and the person is freed. They are let out and can go out and reoffend again. So what has happened is you have a class of professional vigilantes that have sprung up. And if a person can't get justice from the U.S. government, they're going to hire somebody like Virgil Wounded Horse, and they will pay him to go out and beat up an offender and get some justice. And his standard fee is $100 for each bone he breaks and $100 for each tooth he knocks out. So that's the setup.
Sounds like a bargain, frankly, for what he has to go through in this book. So would you say that the first short chapter is fair game for talking about?
Yes, absolutely. It kind of sets the tone.
Okay, so Virgil is the first character we meet in this book, and one of the first things we learn about him is that he is half native, half white, correct?
You know, I don't really specify that he's half white. I specify, that he is an Ayeska, which is a word in our language that means half-breed. Now, originally, Ayeska meant translator, or it also means speaks white. Yeah. And so it's somebody originally that could speak English and could communicate in Lakota and English. But over time, the word has become a slur. So it is sort of an insult. And so if somebody calls you an Ayeska, it's usually a lead in to some pretty bad stuff. And so I don't specify it, you know, I prefer just to kind of leave it there, but that is certainly a reasonable assumption. So
thank you for the correction. I think I must have teased that out from, it does say, it does offer the translation of speaks white in the book. So I think that's probably how it got in my brain, but this is good. It opens it up. So he encounters in this first chapter another character by the name of Gov Yellowhawk. He is a full-blooded native person, and he's a pretty bad dude.
Yes, he is. Gov Yellowhawk is a very, very bad guy. He has been accused of raping both boys and girls at the elementary school that he works at. And the little girl who's been raped by him went to the police, and the family went to the police, and she couldn't get any justice. Gov Yellowhawk comes from one of the most powerful families on the reservation, and so he wasn't prosecuted at all. So the family went to Virgil and said, hey, we need some justice. We want you to go take care of this guy, and we'll pay you. And Virgil says, nope, I'll do it for free. And therein begins chapter one.
Right. There's some brass knuckles involved. There's a baseball bat involved, maybe at least present on scene.
Yes.
And it really sets the tone for this really rip-roaring, super propulsive, intense literary thriller you've got here. I really wondered about where the character of Virgil came from originally.
So, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and I get asked, you know, do you know an actual enforcer? And I have to be honest, I don't. This is something that does exist on my reservation, as well as on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is the Lakota reservation right next to ours. We're kind of like cousins in South Dakota. So it is well known that these people do exist, but I do not know any of them on my own. But of course, I did lots of research when I started writing the book and the original short story from which this comes. You know, I talked to folks. I did sort of my due diligence to find out how it all works before I started writing. So I don't know, you know, an actual hired vigilante, but I know enough that I believe I portrayed this fairly and honestly.
Did the story lead from this character, or did the story lead from the concept of genre? Did you want to write a thriller based on the res?
Well, I wrote the story way back in about 2010, and it was originally a noir story, which meant that the hero has to die at the end.
Yeah.
And indeed, in the short story, I did kill off Virgil at the end of the short story, which was published in 2014 in a native literary journal called Yellow Medicine Review. So he does die in that story. And I liked the story and I thought it was a good story, but it just kept, it stayed with me, this story. And I kept thinking that I hadn't done enough with Virgil Wounded Horse. And so about 2016, I started having this writer's itch. And I said, I need to bring him back. I need to resurrect him. I need to really expand this story into a full book length treatment. So at that point, I decided, though, to make it a thriller in that he would not die, but he would continue on. And so, so it sort of shifted from the noir subgenre to thriller. So that is the genesis of the book.
I get the distinct impression that you are a student of not just genre, but also of plot.
I am. I am. I did my critical thesis in my MFA program on plot and native crime fiction. So, so I'm finally attuned to these differences.
I would love to dig a little bit deeper into that. I'm wondering, honestly, I'm shooting from the hip. I want to talk to you about plot and how you conceive of it and whether you would consider this a Western style plot or something different.
That is such a great question. And in fact, I'm teaching a class on this very topic at the Quelle Festival in a couple of weeks. So this is very much a Western style plot. So it follows sort of the three act structure But I'm teaching a class in which I'll tell the students, you know, about alternate ways of arranging a plot. So native plots do not tend to follow this sort of linear structure. They tend to be more circular. And there are other plot structures as well that a person can use. Now, the problem is that I love the Western three-act linear plot structure. I guess this means that I'm colonized and I accept that. I own it. You know, I love that structure. And so I decided to follow this standard Western structure, but I was going to add my own elements to make it truly an indigenous style book. And I hope that I did accomplish that.
Yeah. This book is also really rich with a lot of cultural criticism, I would say, or cultural commentary. Like the one thing that's springing first to mind is there's a section of it that kind of deals with an indigenous foods movement.
Yes, yes, yes. So
yeah.
That was so much fun to write. So in general, you know, when I conceived of the project for this book, obviously my first goal was to make it a page turner, something that would keep people awake at night. They got to see what happens. How does this story come out? That's what I wanted to do. But I had an underlying goal of trying to bring awareness, because most folks in America have never been on a Native reservation. They're not aware of the problems that we have. They don't know about our broken criminal justice system and the Major Crimes Act. They don't know that our healthcare system is terrible. The life expectancy for a Native man on my reservation is 47 years old. That's a full 30 years younger, you know, for death than outside of the reservation. And we also have problems with getting some decent, healthy, sustainable food. So fry bread is considered to be like the most well-known Native food, but it's not a traditional indigenous food. It's something that our grandparents had to, and great-grandparents had to invent, because we were given these terrible rations by the U.S. government, and they had to whip up something for their family to eat. So unfortunately, Native diets in the last 100 years have not been super healthy. And in the book, I introduce a character, Chef Lack Strongbow, who comes to the res and maybe goes off a little too far on the other side. And he says, you know, you need to eat completely healthy and throw out all sugar and flour and meat and eat as our ancestors did. So I had a lot of fun writing him. I mean, it's a little satirical, but you know, I think he's a good guy in the end.
I would agree with that. There certainly is some humor in the fact that, you know, a Native chef from Washington State comes to the plains to tell everybody there, you know, how to eat traditional foods or indigenous foods. I love that character. And it was just one of the many, like, so there's the plot, there's subplots, there's all of these little estuaries coming out of this book, too. I love it.
Well, thank you. I hadn't thought of the term estuaries, but now that I know it, I'll be using it pretty much every day from here on out. So,
okay. I have many, many questions for you. One I want to make sure to ask, so let's just get to it, is what was your approach to writing about Native spirituality and ceremony in this book in a positive way?
Yeah, that is something that I thought very, very, very much about because, you know, it is a sensitive issue right now, the issue of appropriating another culture's stories. And even within the Native world, it's frowned upon to write about another tribe, or we actually prefer the word nation, to write about another nation's origin stories and such. And it's kind of frowned upon. Now, I am Lakota. You know, these are my stories. But having said that, I still approached it, you know, very carefully. What I did is I took a look at other Lakota writers and Dakota writers who have written about, you know, spirituality in a positive and respectful way. I saw how they did it. Then I went to some of the great scholars of my people. The wonderful intellectual Vine Deloria Jr. has a book on this. And I went to his book. He's passed on, sad to say. I went to his book on Native spirituality. And I saw, you know, how he had approached it. And then I took a look at some books that have been written by some Native medicine men. And I saw how much they had disclosed. So I very much had a boundary of what I felt comfortable writing about. I have taken part in a number of Native ceremonies, and there are some aspects that I would not share.
Right.
But I felt that I had gone, you know, to the point where others had already disclosed. And I also studied their approach. And I thought it was important to talk about Native spirituality in a positive way. I'm proud of my spirituality and my people's spirituality. And so I wanted to show it as a positive force in the book You know, I wanted to counteract the stereotypes. For hundreds of years, we've been called heathens and devilish because we have different ceremonies than the Christian church. And I wanted to fight back against that and show that our spirituality is, in fact, a positive force in our lives. And so I feel that I did do that. But I can tell you, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And just to kind of wrap this up, I've heard from a number of folks who had advanced copies that are Native, and they told me that they have been inspired by my portrayal of Native spirituality and Native ceremonies, and they've returned to their traditional ceremonies. So
that was just
wonderful. So thank you for that great question.
Of course, my pleasure. And that is one hell of a compliment, I'd say.
It was. I mean, honestly, I teared up a little bit when I heard it.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because I really do feel that it comes through in a positive light in the book. And also it's further complicated because I would say the character of Virgil, I hope this is fair, correct me if I'm wrong, I would say that Virgil has sort of an uneasy or not great relationship with Native traditions, at least at the beginning of the book.
Yes, that's his arc. And again, I don't want to give too much away.
Right.
But, you know, okay. But obviously, it's fair to say, I mean, in chapter one, he, you know, in chapter two, he says it. He's like, oh, I don't want any of that crap. I'm tired of our culture and our ceremonies. I want no part of it. And obviously he undergoes a journey. He goes on a journey and there's a change. And I'll just leave it there. But I would say overall that my portrayal of Native spirituality is very much in line with what others have done. And I think, you know, honestly, it's had a positive effect. So I'm very proud of the book.
Maybe a little bit of a lighter take on culture and, you know, portrayal of roadside attractions and amusement parks / Mexican restaurants and arcades. I wanted to talk about your use of kind of these roadside. I mean, one man's roadside attraction is another man's monument. But like Carhenge makes an appearance in this book and also Casa Bonita.
Yes, yes. Oh, did I have so much fun writing those. So Carhenge is a real thing in Alliance, Nebraska. If folks don't know, I would urge listeners to go on Google and look up pictures of this. So some crazy person in an abandoned field on a farm out in Nebraska buried all of these 1970s automobiles on their side, exactly like Stonehenge in England. And just it's open. Anybody can walk in. They don't charge admission. There is a little gift shop. And so, you know, Virgil and Marie, his ex-girlfriend, whom he sparks up with again in about chapter three or four, they take a drive and they stop at Carhenge, which is a real thing. And I just had to write about it. And Virgil has something of a spiritual experience there. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but Carhenge is just a wonderful, crazy, weird thing out in the middle of nowhere. So I had to write about it. Now, Casa Bonita is a whole other thing. It is not uncommercial. It is the very definition of commercial. It is a Denver landmark. So I'm based in Denver, Colorado. So I was born here in a pretty rough neighborhood in Denver, but I would travel every summer to the reservation with my mother and my family. But I'm a Denver native, and I'm back here now, and I love it. But Casa Bonita is this wonderfully weird Mexican restaurant / theme park with cliff divers and caves. And I just had to write about it because it's such a weird piece of Denver. And so I really loved writing that scene.
The love comes through so much so. And I like to hear you say I had to write about it. And I'm just wondering what other loves of yours or passions of yours did you have to write about? What were you excited to include in this book?
It was so fun to write about Denver because, you know, Denver, my beloved city of Denver, has gone through so many changes in the last several decades. We're gentrifying, real estate values are through the roof here, and we're losing a lot of the original Denver. So true Denverites will recognize a lot of stuff in my book that others would not. For example, I have a very brief reference to the comedian Don Becker, who was a gentleman. He had a sort of mental breakdown one night, and he went out on the railroad tracks in Denver, and he put his arms out on the tracks and had them cut off by a passing train. And then he continued to do his comedy act thereafter, you know, telling jokes about how his piano playing has suffered, and which is, I know, it's pretty creepy. And but Don Becker is this, you know, weird. He's passed away, sad to say, but one of the, you know, original Denverites that gave our city so much flavor. Now, I did cut Father Phoney out Father Phony was a gentleman that for 20 years, he dressed up in a ratty old Catholic priest outfit, and he would travel the streets of Denver begging for change from tourists. But we Denverites knew that he was not a priest. He was just scamming people out of their money. And we kind of grew to love him, you know, in a, in a weird sort of way. I did have to cut Father Phony, I'm sad to say.
Oh, I'm sad to hear it.
Yeah, but there are just lots of little, you know, fun Denver things. Like I have Virgil and Marie go into a dispensary, you know, a cannabis dispensary where they talk with a very pompous salesman. And, you know, just I had to throw in a lot of fun Denver stuff.
Oh, it's so rich. But isn't life.
Right.
So it's my understanding that you are not just the author of this fine novel, but you're also the author of a children's book, an attorney, a social scientist, writing a textbook, and a professor.
Yeah, I'm a little embarrassed about all of that. So
really?
it seems a little bit too much, or I don't know. It just seems weird or strange. So it all kind of has to do with my journey to becoming a writer. So I've told this story before, but I grew up in fairly reduced circumstances. A very, very rough neighborhood in Denver. And I'm a first generation college student. Neither one of my parents graduated from college, and they divorced when I was 10. And unfortunately, you know, my mother was in a pretty rough domestic violence situation, and we were homeless at times. And so, you know, I didn't really have good models. And so I did go to the state university, but I made lots of choices that a lot of poor kids do, which is get a good, safe career. So I became an attorney.
Right.
I didn't care for it. But I taught at the local community college, and that was just like a switch going off. It's like, this is great. This is wonderful. So I went back to the University of Texas and I got a PhD. And so I do teach Native American studies, and I'm slowly trying to write a textbook, Introduction to Native American Studies. But about 10 years ago, I thought, well, I need to write. If I'm going to write fiction, now is the time. Now is the time for me to do it. So I did start doing that in what little spare time I have. And then about the children's book, that was really just a labor of love. I was approached in 2017 by the wonderful new publishing house, Raycraft Books. Mm. And they are devoted to marginalized voices. And I pitched a children's book. It's a middle grade book about the great leader of my nation, Chief Spotted Tail. And so I wrote that, and they got these wonderful artists, Jim Yellowhawk, who is a native, and another guy, Pat Kinsella. And the artwork is just fantastic. Now, I do not get any money from that book. I don't get royalties. Instead, I purchased a whole bunch of author copies, and I've shipped for free to every elementary school on the Lakota reservations and every library. And I've also made it clear that any indigenous family that doesn't have the means to purchase a book, I will send them one for free. And so this is really just something that I do because I thought it was important for Native kids to have a book, especially from my nation, the Sichangu Lakota Nation. They needed to have a book with one of their leaders instead of a Crazy Horse or Geronimo or somebody else.
That's so cool, David.
Oh, thank you.
I can't wait to read that biography. I recently read a biography of Elias Parker. By Joseph Bruchak. It's called The One Real American. And I think the subtitle is Elias Parker, Seneca Sachem and U.S. and Civil War General. And it was like, it was so eye-opening. He was a full Native person who learned how to speak English, had all of these rhetorical talents and many other talents, and became the first commissioned officer in the Union Army to be Native, and the first U.S., like, appointed to, I think he was called the Commissioner of Indian Affairs for the country. But he was railroaded by racism and discrimination at every turn. He was an attorney, and they got him out of that, and he was an engineer, and all of these turns in his life he took with just good humor, and his playful intelligence really kept him, you know, moving along throughout his life. Really cool book.
I will keep an eye out for that. I know Joe Bruchak, and he is so prolific. It's not a surprise that I don't know that book because he has at least 20 or 30. And he's just a wonderfully warm, kind guy. He lives out in the country, I believe, in upstate New York, and they have lots and lots of animals. And he's one of the good ones. So I will make a note and I will check that out. And I urge listeners to check out Joe's other stuff as well, because he's just a great writer and a good person.
Oh, he really is. I believe he's an enrolled member of the Abenaki Nation.
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, and he's just a marvelous person to talk to. The one follow-up to that, though, I do want to ask you is it ever hard to suppress your good humor when you're writing a textbook?
So textbook writing is a whole different beast. And for that matter, you know, any sort of journalistic or academic writing is rough, because I have to use a different set of muscles. I published an essay in the New York Times about a month ago on the Major Crimes Act, and I had to kind of take my creative voice out of there. So that's when, you know, I put on the critical hat. And it's just not as much fun to write as fiction. That's just a great fact.
So back to fiction. I hear you've got a sequel to this novel in the works.
I do. I'm working on it right now. Echo was kind enough to give me a 2-book contract. And so, again, I don't want to give away too much, but I think it's fair to say that Virgil Wounded Horse will return in the next book, which is tentatively called Wounded Horse. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of working that out. But it's going to be a fun, fun book. I'm going to build on what happened in Winter Counts. And, you know, you should, that's about 2 years away. You know, I've got the manuscript started, and I would say 2022 would be a reasonable date for that book to appear.
Fair enough. And speaking of the passage of the years, is it too much to ask you to answer, what are Winter Counts?
Oh, yes. I love to talk about this. The title of the book, Winter Counts, refers to the calendar system of the Lakota people. So traditionally, the Lakota people used a pictograph system called Winter Counts. So instead of using numbers or numerals to mark the passage of time, the traditional Lakota way of measuring time was to create on a buffalo hide or something little pictographs, little pictures that would denote the most important events of the year. So Winter Counts, I've always loved the idea of Winter Counts. And, you know, obviously there's a double meaning, because the book is partly set in the winter and it's a tough season. And in the book, Virgil remembers a time when he and his deceased sister would make their own little Winter Counts pictograph system, pictures, calendars as children. And so, yeah, so Winter Counts, I really felt that this was the right name for the book, because I think it just captures a lot of different layers.
Would I be phrasing it correctly to say, what would 2020's winter count be?
Oh, boy. I mean, I think the winter count of 2020 would be all of us huddled over our, you know, our desks, looking into Zoom and, you know, peering outside longingly, wanting to get out. You know, that certainly is what I'll remember this year for. 2019, for me, if this is not too much information, was marked by a different thing. I have two teenage boys. And my youngest son is, both of them are now students, but my youngest son was a student at a school out here in Denver called STEM School Highlands Ranch. And fortunately, he was in the building when there was a school shooting. So two shooters burst into his school and started shooting. He was just two classrooms away, and he heard the shots that killed one of his classmates, a young man called Kendrick Castillo. You know, you read about this in the paper so much, but you never think it's going to happen to you. Right. And I was teaching at my university, and I got a call from my ex-wife. And she's like, "You're screaming, there's been a shooting at Sasha's school. You need to come down here." And so we couldn't reach him on his cell phone. It was awful. It was really every parent's nightmare. And for me, that's what I will always remember 2019, you know, the year of the school shooting. So my poor kids, we lived in New York for a while. They lived through Hurricane Sandy and then the school shooting and now this terrible pandemic. So we all need a break.
My God. Well, one thing, you know, perhaps balm for the soul, your two sons have an excellent novel dedicated to them, as well as to the Lakota people.
I did. Yeah. I just, they're great kids, you know. My youngest son did read the book. My oldest can't be bothered. I'm sad. But I'm trying to shame him into it. You know, I'm like, look, your dad wrote a book. Maybe you want to at least give it a shot reading it, you know? So I think it is dedicated to you, David Jr., you know? So, you know, I'm hoping you will actually read it at some point. Who knows?
I'm sensing now the inspiration for, you know, maybe part of the of a subplot in this book. I will say no more, though. We've given too much. If people want to read this, they're going to have to pick it up.
Look, I think I can express it in a way that doesn't give too much out, you know, let too much out of the bag. So there is a character in the book, Nathan, who is 14. He's the nephew of Virgil Wounded Horse, but Virgil is his guardian. So he's essentially his de facto parent. I've been very open that I based a lot of Nathan on my oldest son, David Jr. Mm-hmm. And so just, you know, the obsession with rap music and video games. And, you know, I very much tapped into that. So sure, you know, maybe that's why David doesn't want to read the book. Maybe he's afraid what he'll see in there.
In so many ways, I view this as a labor of love.
It was. Yeah. I mean, I had to get up every morning at 4 a.m. and write before everybody got up, you know, and I'm at a teaching school, so I teach a lot. I teach at Metropolitan State University of Denver. It's a university for first-generation college students and students of color. And so I love the students there. They're a lot like me. But it means that we work very, very hard. And so, yeah, I did have to get up very, very early and before, you know, anybody else got up. But what a privilege it was to be able to tell the story of the Lakota people. So I'm grateful.
Well, David, it is a privilege to have you on this podcast. And I am really grateful to be able to tell our listeners about this wonderful novel, Winter Counts, by David Heska, Wanblee Wyden. David, thank you so much for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. And thank you to all the readers and listeners. I really mean it.
That was David Heska Wanblee Wyden, author of Winter Counts, out today from Echo. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books this week. We have Young Readers editors Vicky Smith and Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Starting with Vicky, what's your choice for us?
My choice is a book called Everything Sad is Untrue, open paren, a true story, close paren, by Daniel Nayeri. And it's a really, really hard book to characterize, which is one of the things that makes it so amazing. It's based very, very closely on his experiences. He and his sister were born in Iran, and their mother had a conversion experience. She converted to Christianity under the Ayatollah, which is, you know, not a you know, when you're living in Iran, being a Christian at this time is not advisable. So they very quickly come under the attention of the secret police and have to flee first to Abu Dhabi and then to a refugee camp in Rome. And then they are resettled in Oklahoma. So that's the really, really bare bones. And what Nayeri has done with this experience is he's turned it into this sort of interrogation of history and myth and memory. And he interleaves Persian legends and his family's own legends about their own history and his own child understanding of the experiences that he's had. And he tells it in this really discursive manner over the course of a school year as a 12-year-old in Oklahoma. And so it doesn't sound like it would be funny, but it is extremely funny and extremely heartrending at the same time, because what you learn as you read and read and read this story as Khosru, which is Daniel's name as a child, and the name that he gives to his character, is that in order for people to understand him, he has to keep on telling all of these stories, because otherwise he is inexplicable and unknowable. And as you know, I love to do this. I'm going to read you a small bit just to give you a sense of sort of the unbelievable sort of wisdom and earnestness of this narrator. He makes a lot of references, not too surprisingly, to the Arabian Nights. He says, the point of the nights is that if you spend time with each other, if we really listen in the parlors of our minds and look at each other as we were meant to be seen, then we would fall in love. We would marvel at how beautifully we were made. We would never think to be villain kings, and we would never kill each other. Just the opposite. The stories aren't the thing. The thing is the story of the story, the spending of the time, the falling in love. All the good stuff is in between and around the things that happen. It's what you imagine I might be like when I'm not telling you a story, but we're sitting together in silence. Would my hands be fumbling with themselves in my lap? Would I be nervous? Would I love it if you asked about Final Fantasy? And would I say yes if you invited me to your house? Look how much you know about me. And yeah, this is a book that I had a conversation with the reviewer of this book saying, is this really a middle grade book? You know, because not so much that middle graders couldn't appreciate it, but it's so complex that I felt completely fulfilled as an adult reading it. And she said something really smart, which is that adults will be cynical when they're reading the book. Kids will just get it. It's a book that I really hope a lot of people find. I hope that kids read it, and I hope that their parents read it too. It's just a stunning piece of literature.
Vicky, I cannot wait to read this book because one of my top reads of 2019, and I'll probably say ever, is his sister's memoir, The Ungrateful Refugee by Dina Nayeri, which is written for adults. And actually, it's a combination of memoir as well as her own interviews with refugees and asylum seekers. And it's just such a powerful book. It kind of confronts and dismantles a lot of common narratives that dehumanize refugees, often from very well-intentioned people who want to help refugees. And it's just gripping. It's packed with all these layers. It's excellent on audio, but I want to go back. I want to read it in print because there's so much to ponder there. And it's just going to be so interesting to read, you know, a middle grade fiction account by someone who grew up in the same family.
Well, yeah, and you've been talking about this book for months and months now, and I'm kind of ashamed that I haven't read it. But I really feel like after reading this book, I want to read more about this family and more of the story, so I'm extra excited to read The Ungrateful Refugee, perhaps on my upcoming vacation. But yeah, they are an astonishingly talented pair of writers.
Mm-hmm. Vicky's pick this week is Everything Said is Untrue, A True Story, by Daniel Nayeri. Thank you, Vicky, for that choice. Turning now to Laura. Laura, what have you chosen for us?
So this week I have Ilatsoe by Darcy Little Badger, which is a work of speculative fiction that I'm just so excited about. And Ilatsoe means hummingbird in the Lipan Apache language. And that's the name of the main character who goes by Ellie. And so she's a teenager in Texas in this world where it's our world, but with magic sort of enhanced. And Ellie's power is that she's able to reanimate dead animals. So she has a ghost dog. She has her beloved dog, Kirby, died, and she managed to reanimate him. And it's just such a lovely element of the story for anybody, you know, who's an animal lover. Her best friend is Jay, who's a boy of Celtic and Scandinavian heritage. And his power is he can create a will-o'-the-wisp. And he also has permission to travel by fairy ring, which is very, very cool. So the central kind of mystery in the story involves Ellie's cousin, who dies supposedly in a car accident, but he appears to her in a vision and lets her know that, in fact, he was murdered, and he wants her to investigate, you know, bring about justice, and also protect his widow and baby. And so Ellie and her father, they set off, you know, on a road trip across Texas. There's this mysterious town. There's police corruption, there are vampires, there's all this Lipan Apache cultural texture. It's just like nonstop action and just really, also really cool illustrations by Rovina Tsai that just add this kind of enchanting, dreamlike element or contribute to that in the book. And it's so original, so entertaining. And yeah, I could just talk about this book all day.
Thank you, Laura. I was in looking up this book, I noticed that the author is part of a a movement called Indigenous Futurisms. And I wanted, if you could just give us a quick summary of that. It was new to me, and I wonder how far this goes back, and maybe if you have another suggestion for a book within that movement.
Yeah, so it's basically this idea that for a very long time, Indigenous stories were, at least in terms of mainstream publishing, kind of channeled into historical works. But of course, you know, Indigenous people are here in the present and can imagine the future will be around. And so it's this movement to infuse Indigenous cultural elements into a lot of genre fiction. And so, some great names. I'd say Rebecca Roanhorse is an author who's, rising star, arrived star, Anne Boleyn Kwe Malina in Australia. There's Stephen Graham Jones. There's a book I have a very soft spot for, Cherie Dimeline's The Marrow Thieves. That was the Kirkus Prize Young Readers Literature Award winner in 2017 when I happened to be on the jury. So I just have to put it up like for that. But that's such a good book. And there's books Rebecca Roanhorse writes for middle grade all the way through adults as well. Lots to discover.
That's great. Thanks.
And this is really exciting because, of course, the author interview for this episode is David Heska Wambly Wyden, who wrote Winter Counts. And it's a literary thriller set on a reservation in South Dakota. It's very, very cool. I would recommend it to both of you. Thank you, Laura, for that pick. It is Elatsue by Darcy Little Badger. Next, we've got Nonfiction with Eric. Eric, what's your choice?
My choice is a book I'm delighted to see on the bestseller list. It's the new book by Isabel Wilkerson. It's called Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. And of course, she wrote The Warmth of Other Suns a few years ago, a Pulitzer Prize winner. This one looks at, you know, a lot of us think of the caste system. We think of India, and that does figure a little in the book. But what she does an amazing job showing how there's, you know, caste-based divisions throughout the U.S. And it's a really good example. I mean, it's certainly timely, but she gets into the nuances of a lot of our divisions in ways that other authors don't. I think a lot of people like to think of everything as black and white divided, but she kind of shows these gradations of inequality throughout the country and how that, you know, there has to be a bottom rung for the middle rung to compare itself to. So there's, you know, various rungs based on class, economics, social codes, et cetera. And it's just, every page was pretty eye-opening to me. And she talks a lot about how, at least toward the end, how the U.S. is going to become a majority minority country. Demographics are going to shift quite a bit in the next couple decades. And she makes the good point that it's important for us to be, well, I'll just give a quote. She says, "We are responsible for ourselves and our own deeds and misdeeds in our time and in our own space, and will be judged accordingly by succeeding generations." And I think it's obviously a perfect time for this book. I think it's got the makings of a classic. I think it's going to be one of the most significant books of this decade. So highly recommended.
I can't wait to read this, Eric. I read The Warmth of Other Suns. When it came out, it didn't only win the Pulitzer, but it won the National Book Critics Circle Award, which is, you know, we like that one since we're book critics. So I read it then. And Wilkerson reminds me of someone like Robert Caro. You know, she's writing history, but she's a journalist, and she interviews people like a journalist and gets so deep into them. And
she does,
you know, but then also has the ability to write history like a real storyteller. And so she's just really smart, and the books are so engaging and readable also.
Absolutely. Yes, pretty unique ability. It was a good comparison.
Yeah.
Eric's pick this week is Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. Thank you, Eric, for that choice. And finally, we have Fiction with Lori. Lori, what'd you pick for us?
I've got a book called Summer by Allie Smith. If that sounds familiar to you, it's because in the last 3 years, she's also written Autumn, Winter, and Spring. And this is the last book in her seasonal quartet, which is just an incredible series of really smart, beautifully written, brainy, you know, amazing novels written so fast, almost, again, like journalism. She came up with this idea a few years ago before I mean, she's British, she's Scottish, so she's focusing on what was going over there. So before the Brexit vote, before Trump was elected, and a lot of things changed in the world. So she was already thinking about this, and the book came out, the first book, Autumn, came out pretty soon after the Brexit announcement, the vote. And it was, you know, seen as the first Brexit, post-Brexit novel. And now, and she's just kind of kept up at this pace of one a year. And as you know, so many things have happened. And each book is quite separate. You don't need to read them in order or read them together, but they do really resonate with each other. And there are some characters who pop up from one book to the other. And especially in this one, the last book, some characters from the earlier books do pop up. This book focuses on a family living in London. There's a 16-year-old daughter named Sasha, who's really bright and very, very liberal. She's on strike against riding in any vehicle that uses gas. And she has a brother, Robert, who's 13, who's the complete opposite. He's very in favor of the conservative government and Brexit. And he's also very mischievous. He's introduced in the first few pages because the TV is really loud, and Grace, who's their mother, and Sasha can't turn it down because Robert has hidden the remote control before he left for school. And the TV's so old and broken that there are no dials on the actual TV that they can use. So they're stuck with this blaring TV for the whole day. So he's a bit of a terror. Their father has left them to move in with a younger woman, but the two of them just live next door. So it's sort of about their family, and they cross paths with Daniel, who was protagonist of the first book, Autumn. He, at that time, I think he was 101. Now he's 104, and he was a German immigrant. So his story features into this as he looks back on when he was held in a detention camp for enemy aliens during the Second World War. And that, you know, brings in all the different people who are in detention and migrants of all different kinds in a way that's very relevant to what's going on today. And there are just all these other elements of art and literature. Every book kind of focuses on a different visual artist. One book has a fashion designer who comes into it a lot. This book has a lot of parallels with The Winter's Tale from Shakespeare. And always in all of Smith's books, there's just a lot of wordplay, which she loves. I just want to read you, taking a page from Vicky's book, the first few lines of the book. Each of these books starts in a kind of omniscient, godlike voice, just talking to you, just for a page or two. So this one, this is how this book starts. It says, "Everybody said, so? As in, so what? As in, shoulder shrug? Or, what do you expect me to do about it? Or, I so don't really give a fuck? Or, actually, I approve of it. It's fine by me." So she's kind of summoning up the political atmosphere just by focusing on this one word. So, and there's a lot of that kind of wordplay in the book. Robert, the 13-year-old, loves words and he plays with them a lot. And also Ashley, who's the dad's girlfriend, is writing a book about political uses of different words. So there's a lot going on in the book with that. I just wrote a column for the magazine about how I like to wait to read series until they're all finished. I did read Autumn when it came out, and then I've been waiting till summer comes so I can read all the rest of them, although I haven't been doing them in order because I wanted to read summer first while it's still timely. But, you know, if you haven't read these, I just really recommend all of them or any of them. They're really terrific.
You know, Lori, it boggles my mind that what is clearly a very carefully crafted and structured book is able to talk about both COVID and George Floyd. It's like, was she just writing, you know, up to the moment when they just grabbed it out of her hands and sent it to the press? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, they're not a huge part of the book, but they are in there. And I mean, I spent the early months of the quarantine emailing the publicist every couple of weeks saying, "Do you have the galley yet?" And she'd be like, "She's still writing it." And I would say, is it still supposed to come out in August? You know, this was sort of March, April, May, like, I, you know, yeah, she was writing it up until the very last minute.
Kudos. Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Lori's pick for the week is Summer by Ali Smith. Lori, thank you very much for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Eula Biss, author of the New York Times bestseller On Immunity, among others. Her latest essay collection is called Having and Being Had. So I'm excited for that. But until that time, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.